Yeah, we took my cousin Fee, who's at Brampton meeting. My favourite oratorio is Mendelssohn's Elijah. She was going with Ralph and said, "You're very ought to come along." One of the features was verse 27, that Mickey Turkey. I wish I could replicate it. Cry aloud for his God, he's either talking or pursuing. Or he's in a journey or peradventure his sleeves and must be awake. He came up really well in that. Anyway, there's something else that you might have noticed about Elijah. He goes to people and says, "I'm the only prophet." It seems to completely ignore there's another 101 lying around in earlier in the chapter, Obadiah and his 100 prophets in the cave. And he also seems to have ignored it when he was on the mountain with the still-blowing voice. "I'm the only one left," he says. I think this is just a little aside about envy, is that sometimes it makes us want to think we're the only one. Whether the Christians are the only people who've got the truth, or whether we're the only one or the best in the job, it's one of the little things that can eat away at you. Now, it's not really that I want to talk about. It's more of an assessment of the character. And generally speaking, I will, if I can, make out a case for somebody being better than we might imagine. I like to make out a case for Esau, for instance. I won't do that right now. But I do remember once, this was youth circle days, that we had this quite heated discussion on Ahab, all the things that he did. And the general verdict on Ahab was that he was henpecked by Jezebel, and really didn't mean much destruction or harm on anybody. I find it quite telling that actually, it was a madman. Because did you see what Obadiah said about him? He sends people right round the world, gets them to sign an oath saying, "We haven't seen Elijah." Vindictive. That's what he was. He was also odd and pathetic. I remember not raising this particular point, but I remember just quoting two scriptural quotes about him. One was the chapter before, "And Ahab the son of Omri did the evil in the sight of the Lord above all that were before him." And then towards the end in chapter 21, that's Naboth the Midian, Naboth's chapter, "And there was none like unto Ahab, which did sell himself to work wickedness in the sight of the Lord, whom Jezebel and his wife stirred up." Now, those are scriptural verdicts. Take them or leave them. Now, one verdict that is never made by scripture, that's on Pontius Pilate. The verdicts made by Pontius Pilate are usually found in secular history. And in secular history, the view is that they didn't know where he came from, but he might have been born in Scotland. That he was a bit of a desperate and pathetic man at the same time. That he made a jolly old mess of ruling the land of Israel. And that towards the end of his life he made a mess of things again. But there's one chapter in his life where secular history not recorded in him as being particularly evil or nasty. And that is the crucifixion of Jesus. And I find that quite interesting. That's what secular history says. Rubbish beforehand. Did what he could, time of Jesus, and maybe rubbish afterwards. But we don't know that. And the fact is that we don't know where he was born, we don't know where he died, and we don't know why he died. But I think it's reason to suggest that certainly before the time of Jesus, or up to the time of Jesus, he wasn't a good leader. But then I thought to myself, can you make out a case for him? Deuteronomy 21. Let's try this. I'm going to read you 9 verses of this, the first 9 verses. See if you can pick the relevance. I don't think it's that difficult once it is spotted. If one be slain in the land which the Lord our God gives it to possess it, lying in the field, and we do not know who has slain him, then thy elders and thy judges shall come forth, and they shall measure unto the city which shall round about him that is slain. And it shall be that the city which is next unto the slain man, even the elders of that city, shall take heifer which hath not been wrought with, and which hath not drawn in the yoke. And the elders of that city shall bring down the heifer into a rough valley, which is neither ear nor sown, and shall strike off the heifer's neck there in the valley. And the priest, the son of Levi, shall come here near, for then the Lord thy God hath chosen to minister unto him, and to bless him in the name of the Lord, and by their words shall every controversy and stroke be held. There's only one relevant bit in this bit, that was the dead man. And they don't know who killed him. At the time of Jesus, if you can look at the time of Jesus and say, who killed Jesus? I mean, who wanted to have him dead? You couldn't pick on any particular person. There were lots of them. All the Sanhedrin there too. And the people that were stirred up in the judgment hall. So to that extent, there is a man who you can't decide who was actually killed him, because many did. Alright, here we go on, this is where it starts getting interesting. And all the elders of that city, that are next unto the slain man, shall wash their hands over the heifer that is beheaded in the valley. And they shall answer and say, our hands have not shed this blood, neither have our eyes seen. Be merciful, O Lord, unto thy people of Israel, whom thou hast redeemed, and lay not innocent blood unto thy people of Israel's charge, and the blood shall be forgiven them. So thou shalt put away the guilt of the innocent that blood from among you, when thou shalt do that which is right in the sight of the Lord. Well, washing the hands gives you the clue, doesn't it? And that's really what sparked me to make the verdict I have made. Maybe wrong verdict, but the idea that God can save even desperados like Pontius Pilate is certainly a possibility, that's for sure. And the declaration is made. Pilate makes a declaration, washes his hands and says, I haven't done it. And I think that's a fair declaration. I think he was pretty much powerless to do anything about it. I surveyed a few people in the meeting, forget where it was now, and I said, right, can you name one individual who could have stopped that riot and released Jesus? Can you name one person who could have managed it? And, the two suggestions came up, and none of them were absolutely convincing. The only one that came up that was the least bit convincing was Jesus could have stopped it. That's about it. I doubt even that Mrs. Pilate could have stopped it. I wouldn't like to have been Pilate when he went home that night. Pontius, did you let that man go like I told him to do? I can imagine hanging his head, dead looking in the eye. Sorry, didn't manage it. Couldn't. Overwhelmed by them. And you can imagine Mrs. Pilate saying to him, you stupid pathetic little man. Of course it's true about his past things. And she probably turned to pack and go back to Scotland, or whatever it might be, wherever he was born from. Whether she can do any better? Doubt it. Can't think of anybody. Could Moses have done any better? You know, but Moses himself is confronted by riots and says, "Lord, you know, why are you putting this burden on me? I can't handle it." So, it's a pity in a way that the Apostles' Creed, which I actually very much like in every respect, but that says, "Suffered under Pontius Pilate." Well, not really. He suffered under the Jews. Pontius Pilate wasn't a Jew. He was a Roman or a Scotsman or whatever, but he was not a Jew, that's for sure. So, what I think has happened is that he was probably appointed by the Romans to run Jerusalem because Israel was, I think, pretty much the government. So they wouldn't pick the best men for the job. The idea was to enforce the Pax Romana without using too much force, but if it could be enforced without much force, then desperate measures could be used. And I think the interesting desperate measure, which is about the only thing that was said about Pontius before Jesus' time, was in Luke chapter 13, and it's the story about the sacrifice that Pilate, the blood of the sacrifice that Pilate makes for those of the Galileans. Now, to me, that he was probably trying to quell some kind of a riot. I don't know, no idea, but it was. He didn't handle it right, and it seems that also, as desperate men do, he got vindictive about it. No point in blood, and it was almost as if to make a statement to the Jews. Yeah, I've killed these, and I've got no respect for you whatsoever. And the blood I'm going to mix with your sacrifice because they're useless because I've killed you a lot anyway. And they wouldn't be impressed. Now, what strikes me about it is that those who came to tell Jesus what exactly they'd say, because Jesus would have known about it himself. And Jesus would turn around and say, "You know, that can happen to anybody. And if you don't repent, it will happen to you. And furthermore, an act of God is no different. You don't repent from an act of God that brings out an earthquake that brings down the Tower of Siloam. You're no different from any of them." One of the things that strikes me about that is he made not one word of criticism about Pilate. Not one word. And what else he did is he actually, Jesus showed himself to be, actually the ideal Christadelphian position, which is absolutely apolitical. But better than that, he not only is absolutely apolitical, but he actually draws meditation from it. And I think that's fabulous. I mean, we've had it written in the magazine why we don't vote and all the rest of it. There's not one word of exhortation in any of that. Not one word. We don't do it. We just say, "Don't vote." End of story. For whatever reason, actually, I find them rather weak. But that's besides the point. The non-politics, Jesus always, but always, turned to an exhortation. And he said absolutely neutral. And nobody in the right mind could pick a hole in what he did. Somebody in the wrong mind could. Because the interesting thing was the other time when he was asked to get involved in politics, one of the other times was actually when they asked him whether he should pay taxes. And he said, "Well, let's have a look then. The coins that you have in your pocket, take one out now and let me have a look at it." He said, "Well, you can see as well as I can whose head it is on it, and therefore it belongs to him." That puts him absolutely neutral, but he walked one step further. And while we're at it, you're in the image of God. You belong to God. And you've got to give to God what it belongs to. And I think Pilate would have heard that. I think Pilate would have noticed what happened about the story his big thing with the sacrifice. And Herod also, that very week, when challenged about his political position, he stayed absolutely neutral, brought out an exhortation. Now, absolutely remarkable. So there you are, you have a man who now sees that Jesus is absolutely no threat whatsoever. But what happens? The Jews come to him and say, he's stopped us paying taxes to Caesar. An absolute bunkum. And he'll know it. He'll know that it's for envy that they're living up, because when they come up with some cock and bull story like that, he knows it's absolute nonsense. And he says, and he's desperate to let Jesus go, not just, I think, because of the intervention of Mrs. Pilate, but he can't see anything wrong with him. What's wrong with him? He'd have been crushed by his silence, by his peacefulness, by his statement as if my kingdom were of this world, then of my servants. Right. He realised there was absolutely no threat. I suspect also, you know, there were four people that were eligible for release on that day. There was two thieves, there was Barabbas, and there was Jesus. And I suspect he picked the very worst example he could to release. A thief, a murderer, and an insurrectionist. And one of the records, I think it's the Mark records, says the people begged for Barabbas to do to them as he always ever had done. And that would be bad news. Everybody hates him, even the Jews hates him. The Romans certainly didn't like him. Nobody liked him. He had a friend in the world, one of the worst people that could ever be imagined, I imagine. He said, here's this piece of rubbish. There's Jesus, your king. Who do you want? And it says, when he found that he could prevail nothing, he washed his hands. Did you blame him? Would we have done any better? All right, in a bad career before that, but in his handling of Jesus, did he really do much wrong? I suspect also that when he had Jesus thwacked, as he did, they had him thwacked so hard to shorten his period of suffering. You notice the other two thieves didn't manage to carry the crosses, or it didn't say they didn't. It's on record that Jesus didn't manage it, or at least they got somebody, they pressed gang somebody into helping him. Now, after that, they all go home. I don't know what he thought about Jesus being cast on the rubbish heap. I can imagine there would be a sigh of relief when just two men who've been scared before, like most of us would have been in the circumstances, in the face of such terrible opposition, two scared men came out boldly. They came out boldly, and unlike the disciples who fled, they believed that the death of Jesus, in my opinion, was leading to a greater promise, resurrection. So they came out boldly without being scared this time. Come to the governor, they beg the body of Jesus. And I think Pilate would be highly relieved. So he's sensibly running across to the killing fields just to check he's really dead. And he probably sends and says, come back quickly, we haven't got long to bury him properly. And the fact that Jesus was given a decent burial, I can imagine him saying to Nicodemus and Joseph, you know, look after him for me. I didn't want to put him in, but I had no choice. And I'm so relieved that he isn't going to go on the rubbish heap. Another thing that I mean, I'm only guessing on this, but one thing that is written is the sign of the cross. And it was written in three languages. Hebrew, Latin, Greek. He'll be a witness to the Jews that they have killed their king. He'll be a witness to the world, in Greek, that he was a king. And he was indeed a king. He was going to remain a king or become a king. And he'd written it to his own people in Latin so that Rome would know what would happen. The one, the positive exhortation, I think, would be the one that wrote to the Greeks. It says to the whole world, here's your king. And they ask him to take it down. He says, no, I'm not going to take it down. You've had your day. Here's your king. What I have written, here's your king. And I believe that he actually looked into the resurrection as well. The Jews came to him, and I imagine he's saying, oh, what now? What do you want now? You haven't got everything you want. They said, well, we're frightened he's going to come out there. And I presume that meant that they actually believed he was going to come out. Probably didn't want him to come out because otherwise he'd juice them. But, so he says, I want you to protect where he's buried. And I find this really interesting. He says to him, you've got your guard. Go make it as sure as you can. And I bet under his breath he said, you've got no chance, it's coming out. Now, if God can save bad people like Pilate who could protest their innocence, believe in Jesus and believe that he is risen from the dead. And I think he can save most people, including us.